Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. David French of National Review in today once again for Jim Garrity. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives. And as we mentioned yesterday, David is both a veteran and a lawyer, and his legal experience has come in handy both days, and it certainly will here in the good martini. This is, I think, fairly rare, but I want to get your analysis on this, David. This is from the National Law Journal's Zoe Tillman, finding that Justice Department lawyers repeatedly misled the court about when the government would be implementing new immigration directives. U.S. District Judge Andrew Hanen ordered any Washington-based Justice Department lawyer who wants to appear in any state or federal court in the 26 states that sued the administration to attend an annual legal ethics course. He also ordered Attorney General Loretta Lynch to present a comprehensive plan to the court within 60 days about how to prevent future unethical conduct. This is what Hanen actually said. This court has found no authority to support the concept that it is ever ethical and appropriate conduct to mislead a court and opposing counsel, nor has the government provided any authority to that effect. That being the case, the court finds no need for a comprehensive dissertation on the duty of candor and honesty because counsel in this case failed miserably at both. The government's lawyers in this case clearly violated their ethical duties. To say that the government acted contrary to its multiple assurances to this court is at best an understatement. The government knowingly acted contrary to its representations to this court on over 100,000 occasions. This court finds that the misrepresentations detailed above were false, made in bad faith, misled both the court and the plaintiff states. And after giving some more details about that, he says the misconduct in this case was intentional, serious, and material. In fact, it is hard to imagine a more serious, more calculated plan of unethical conduct. There were over 100,000 instances of conduct contrary to counsel's representations. Such a sizable omission cannot be classified as immaterial, unquote. So, David, first of all, how rare is it for the court to read the riot act to the government like this, and what's your reaction to Hanen doing it?
Two things. One, unfortunately, it's not as rare as you might think. There is a recent history of Department of Justice attorneys getting absolutely crushed by federal courts for unethical conduct. Why is that? Because Department of Justice attorneys have been engaged in unethical conduct. But this one, even by that standard, is extraordinary. And here's why. Here's essentially what the government did. This is all about the Obama Executive Amnesty Program, DAPA, D-A-P-A. And so what the government did is it told the court that the program was not underway and would not be underway for a couple of months. And so the court believed it had time to decide the case and decide the state's attempt to enjoin the program. And it did, in fact, enjoin the program, an opinion that was upheld by the Court of Appeals. But here's the problem. The government lied to him the whole time. They were telling him that the program wasn't underway when it was already underway, and more than 100,000 illegal aliens had been granted lawful status under this program. That's just extraordinary. So here's what had happened. The Obama administration implemented a lawless executive amnesty that defied the will of Congress and then lied to a court as to whether it had already started and was busily handing out amnesty, essentially, to more than 100,000 people behind the court's back. And so I've never seen the kind of penalty that this court imposed. The court did not have the power to disbar these attorneys, although it did strip them of the right to practice in that case before the court. But, you know, that requirement of ethics training, that's a five-year requirement. And he also required that the government give lists of all of the people granted amnesty who live in those 26 states. And presumably, in case they ultimately the states win, they would have the list of all those people unlawfully granted amnesty, so they would know where they were. So it was extraordinary.
And David, given the fact that the district court and the appeals court have sided with the states, if we're headed towards what is likely a 4-4 deadlock from the Supreme Court, then this matters a lot in those states, right?
Absolutely, it matters a lot. And here's the thing, even if the Supreme Court rules against the states, this is still unethical conduct. This is not conduct that's made okay by if the states lose, because no matter what, every party or every attorney appearing in a court, whether you're winning or you're losing, you have a duty to tell the truth to the court. I'm staggered by this. I have practiced law in federal courts from coast to coast, and I had never in all of my cases, including incredibly contentious culture war cases, fought against attorneys who were zealously on the other side, hard left, radical attorneys, I've never in my career encountered an attorney who willfully and brazenly lied to a federal court. It just does not happen much. But unfortunately, it's happening more and more, apparently, with the Department of Justice.
And Hanen did say in his statement also that he does not specifically blame Loretta Lynch very much, which is a pretty obvious allusion to the fact that he blames Eric Holder a lot for this, given that this case began under Eric Holder's time at the Justice Department.
Right. That's one thing that was sort of left hanging in the air, was this is all Eric Holder's fault. And the other thing he did was he went out of his way to say that the local U.S. Attorney's Office in Texas had not misled him, which would have been truly career suicide for those guys, because those are the guys who have to appear before him day in, day out over their entire careers. So fortunately, the Texas U.S. attorneys maintain some their dignity. But wow, I mean, you know, it's funny, though, this judge is known for being a little bit more colorful in his opinions. And in that opinion, he actually quoted from the movie Bridge of Spies and also the movie Miracle on 34th Street. So he'll go to legal authority, he'll go to moral authority, and he'll go to Hollywood authority to make his case.
Maybe a little bit of a cut from Judge Scalia there with some of his references. But
right.
David, I hope you're sitting down, because as we start our bad martini here, it begins with the fact that Donald Trump agreed to an interview with Sean Hannity on the Fox News channel.
What? Finally?
And it turned out that it was a fairly friendly interview as well. So the shockwaves just keep coming here. One of the things they were talking about, of course, as this race appears to be shaping up more as a Trump versus Clinton general election, was the legacy of Bill Clinton, and specifically his legacy with women, since there's been so much attention, including the recent New York Times piece, to Trump's treatment of women over the years. And so Andrea Mitchell of NBC decided to report on one aspect of this exchange between Trump and Hannity. The clip here starts with Hannity and Trump talking about Bill Clinton's legacy, and it concludes with Mitchell's analysis.
It's about groping and fondling and touching against a woman's will.
And rape.
And rape.
Donald Trump using that word unprompted during an interview last night with Fox News' Sean Hannity, bringing up a discredited and long-denied accusation against former President Bill Clinton, dating back to 1978 when he was Arkansas Attorney General. Late last night, the Clinton campaign responded in a statement that read, "Trump is doing what he does best, attacking when he feels wounded, and dragging the American people through the mud for his own gain."
NBC News has reached out to the Trump campaign this morning to ask why he brought up that long-denied Bill Clinton allegation. So far, no response.
Long denied by Bill Clinton and, I guess, Hillary Clinton, David, but discredited? No one's ever proven that Juanita Broderick, who's obviously the woman involved in that allegation, who's not mentioned by Andrea Mitchell, she's certainly standing by that. And as recently as 2014, the NBC reporter who initially did that story, Lisa Myers, was standing by that story.
Right. Whatever happened to hashtag believe all women?
Right.
Here's what we know about the Juanita Broderick accusation compared to many of the accusations that have earned, for example, women invitations to the State of the Union address. And that is that Juanita Broderick's accusation is supported by far more evidence than many of the famous allegations that we've seen, such as the quote-unquote mattress girl in Columbia. If a similar allegation was made now against a conservative politician, Juanita Broderick would be a heroine of the feminist left, as a brave, quote, survivor, unquote. Not only did she make an accusation, she had other people who said that she repeated that allegation to them at the time. Now, obviously, it's a he said, she said situation, but to call it discredited is absurd. And yes, there is contrary evidence contradicting her claims as well. So to say that it's discredited is a judgment that Andrea Mitchell is not qualified to make, and especially in an atmosphere where we have seen far less credible allegations of sexual assault and rape result in circumstances where Democratic officials have demanded changes in the law, have tried to ruin people's careers and lives. So this is just absurd, and it's an absurd double standard, which always seems to benefit Bill Clinton.
Where do you think this puts the mainstream media, that they're still defending Bill Clinton, but at the same time trying to go on the offensive with Trump? I'm sure you're not interested in really defending either one of them and their conduct with women, but the ethical pickle that it puts them in.
Well, you know, I don't think they think it's an ethical pickle, honestly. I mean, this is old hat for them. I mean, there are a lot of these are the same journalists that covered Clinton in the 1990s and eagerly and gleefully participated in campaigns to destroy the reputations of women who accused Bill Clinton of misconduct. And then, without batting an eye, turned around and gleefully participated in campaigns to turn our colleges and universities, for example, into institutions that deny due process rights to men, that presume the guilt of men. And then they're now going to turn right back around, now that we have another Clinton in the news and in the crosshairs, and say, gleefully defend Bill Clinton again. Because it's not about the actual principle. It's about who's winning and who's losing. So they're going to defend their side. They're going to oppose the other side, no matter sort of the underlying principle at stake.
Let's move on to the crazy martini now. And for that, we go to a piece written by your colleague at National Review, Kat Timpf. And the title is School Board Votes to Ban Having Valedictorians. It reads, a school board in North Carolina has unanimously given initial approval to a policy that would stop allowing its high schools to name valedictorians and salutatorians of its graduating classes because that kind of competition is apparently hazardous to students' health. Quote, we have heard from many, many schools that the competition has become very unhealthy, unquote, Wake County School Board Chairman Tom Benton said, according to an article in the News and Observer. Benton said he thinks this change will also stop students from being tempted to fill their schedules with easier classes to pad their GPAs in pursuit of a valedictorian or salutatorian title. Quote, students were not collaborating with each other the way that we would like them to, he said. Their choice of courses was being guided by their GPA and not their future education plans. And as Kat points out, they're still going to have a GPA. It's still going to help determine what classes they take because they want to get into the best colleges, and that always helps. And they're always going to know where they stand in the class. So, David, what do you make of this latest attempt to give everyone a trophy and not make the kids who don't get the top honors not feel bad about themselves?
You know, this is the old, if everybody can't get a trophy, then nobody can get a trophy. But, you know, this isn't new. I mean, my high school in rural Kentucky in 1987 would not designate class rank and would not publicly designate class rank, although students knew it, and would not publicly, at graduation, honor valedictorian, salutatorian. When I was in law school at Harvard, there was no public class rank that was announced. You know, you just kind of, there were honors that were given out, but you had to guess at your class rank. And this is not a new thing, and it's all part of this idea and this notion that, well, we just don't want to make people feel bad. All you're doing is just making it harder for students to determine where they stand. But guess what? Students try to figure that out anyway. My son, when he was younger, he played in some leagues where they didn't keep score when he was much younger. And by golly, those kids kept score. They knew. So you're never going to legislate away human nature. People are going to want to know where they stand, and they're going to compete with each other, and they're going to try to do their best. And so the social engineering is a miserable failure. It's always been a miserable failure, and it will always be a miserable failure, but they won't stop trying.
If Jim Garrity were here, he would quote the former coach of his beloved New York Jets, Herm Edwards, who once said, "You play to win the game." And that's true in academics. It's true in sports. And why in the world they're trying to convince kids that that's not the way the real world works is probably one of the reasons we have some of the issues we have with the kids on college campuses right now, I would guess.
Well, yeah. And you know what? When you scratch the surface of some of these policy reforms, you'll often find a sad story of a well-connected son or daughter who had their feelings hurt and had the ability to make things change. It's amazing how many times a lot of these little changes that seem ideological are often quite personal in response to the complaints and upset of some really well-connected people in any given community. And, you know, it's just, look, my view is I'm very down on public schools at this moment. And this is just a further affirmation that Americans need to start thinking about declaring independence from public schools, or should we say government schools.
Amazing. Whatever happened to celebrating actual achievement? David, great to have you with us the past couple of days. Thanks so much for filling in for Jim, and we'll talk to you later.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
David French of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. Please join Jim and me on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great weekend, everyone.